international loan finance. I have provided a chapter on euro dollar market, euro loan market, focusing specifically on the syndicated lending market. We're looking at the background to the euro loan market, the euro loan system. We're looking at loan facilities and how we can use the same standard documentation, the same key core financing arrangements, and a whole other wide range of different facilities. We'll look at loan structures, issue procedure, syndication. We'll look at lead bank agent bank liability, loan conditions and obligations, loan default remedies, loan transfers, and loan restructuring. All of that is covered in the paper. So what we're looking at is this. International loan markets are amongst the most important, largest markets in the world. This is how governments raise funds. All the major governments in the world have to borrow because they don't want to put taxation up. How do they cover their other costs? They cover it through going to the bond markets. The largest companies in the world also want to borrow. Even if they're highly profitable, even if they make massive amounts of money, they're still going to borrow so they can fund other activities, expansion activities, new products, new services, activities in other countries, as well as acquisitions, buying other companies. So this is one of the most important markets in the world. This is worth estimated over $100 trillion. So what we're looking at is this. It's the core functions of banks and banking. What do? Banks collect in funds, they pool those funds, and they on-lend them. At the international level, however, and specifically in the euro-dollar market, it's slightly different. Because what we have is this. The euro-dollar system was established after the Second World War and essentially comprises an interbank market, a euro-loan market, and a euro-dollar market. And what will simply happen is this. When countries or governments want to borrow, and companies want to borrow under the euro loan market, the participating banks in that market go into the interbank system and they draw down at that time. They don't, it's not like deposit lending, domestic banking at the retail level, at the national level. They don't have to collect deposits, pull them in and lend them. The banks only obtain the funds that they need to lend in the euro dollar system when they're advised money's required, there's a drawdown, they will then go into the market at that time and draw down. So for example, in a typical type of situation, we're lending, let's say 100 million, we have 10 banks, 10 borrowers. One borrower, one parent company with 9 subsidiaries, 10 banks make up the syndicate providing the lending. It's very rare to provide the whole 100 million on closing when the loan agreement is signed or even under a single drawdown after that. That's quite unusual. Usually what will happen is the borrowers will draw down using utilization requests or drawdown statements, drawdown filings over a period, very often a commitment period. You will have a term loan for a fixed period. You will also have a revolver, which allows you to draw down smaller amounts, repay them, draw down, repay, draw them down, repay. Both of those may have a limit. They may have a commitment period of availability, for example, 2 years. Very common for the term loan to, let's say, have a 2 year availability period. And then for the revolver, it could be the same 2 year, or it might last for the whole of the facility. So what we're going to do is we're going to have a large number of loans governed by single set of standard documentation. At the international level in the euro loan markets, what simply happens is this. When the borrowers want to draw down a specific amount, they notify the agent bank. The agent bank advises each of the syndicate members, and only at that time will the syndicate bank then go into the market and draw down the money. And what will it pay for that? It will pay the relevant, what we call the interbank rate. It used to be LIBOR, the London Interbank Offered Rate. Now it's what we call a risk-free rate. And then the separate risk-free rates for different financial centres. The most commonly used risk-free rate in London is now SONIA, Sterling Overnight Interbank or Interest Average. So effectively what's going to happen is this. The syndicate bank goes in, each of the 10 syndicate banks goes into the market separately, draws down the amount it requires for its contribution, and then makes that available. It will pay SONIA, plus the borrower will pay the margin. The margin will be a fixed standard profit that the bank expects to receive, normally expressed in terms of basis points. So it won't be 1.5 or 2.5, it'll be 150, 50, 200, 250. So the borrowers will pay Sonia the interbank rate plus the margin. These have become increasingly important over time, simply as governments and companies always need to borrow facilities. What's then developed is that we have a large number of different types of facilities, and I expand on and deal with all of this in the chapter. So we've got simple facilities are bilateral or direct loans with a syndicated group. The reason we syndicate it is that no one bank will want to take on all of the credit risk. It will spread that risk by bringing other banks into the syndicate. We can then, however, have different types of syndicates. So we could have a fully open, clear syndicate, a normal standard syndicate, or we could have a participated or a blind syndicate, where there's other banks standing behind the commitments to provide the funds, but the borrowers don't know that. And we'll come back and we'll look at this when we consider participations and sub-participations and other forms of transfer later. We can have multi-currency facilities, we can have multi-purpose facilities, we can have committed, we can have uncommitted, we can have guide facilities or advice facilities. That's a form of non-committed facility, but funds will be available if it's appropriate at that time. You can have back-to-back or parallel loans, you can have subordinated loans, we can have secured loans, leveraged loans, guaranteed loans. There's a whole series of different types of facilities that we can use all of this for. But in each case, we've got a standard, basic, underlying credit relationship. And we're going to see the core sets of terms and obligations that apply in each case, essentially based on the financial provisions, the obligations made up of the conditions precedent, the representations and warranties, and the covenants, and then the default clauses. Those are the three key things: the financials, the obligations, and the defaults. In terms of the financials, we'll see on the paper here in the fourth paragraph, you've basically got the amount, the principal. We need to agree the fixed amount that's going to be made available. There's the duration, is the term for how long will these funds be available. There's the advance or the drawdown. Is it going to be in a single amount, or is it in tranches over a period? And is it drawable down by more than one borrower, as we've said already? You then have repayment or maturity, repayment of principal, and then you have the supporting obligations. So we'll need to consider all of the separate clauses which apply to each of those, and I expand all of that in the chapter. Now, the loan market has always been of very substantial importance. What did happen, however, was by the end of the 60s into the 1970s, the loan market goes down slightly in terms of relative importance, simply because the bond market and the note market rise in importance. Bond markets tend to be for fixed periods, fixed interests, fixed interest rates, usually on parallel term to the loans. So the early loans may have been for, say, 20 years. The company concerned could either enter into a direct loan relationship with a syndicate of banks, or it could issue bonds into the market for the equivalent period. What tends to happen is, if you're issuing bonds, you can get a finer margin, a finer coupon. So if you have good credit standing in the market, you can borrow more at a lower cost. That's the general rule. With a bond, it's generally fixed. What then happens is, at the beginning of the 1970s in particular, following the closure of the Bretton Woods system of fixed currency arrangements, which actually technically began with an announcement by President Richard Nixon on a State of the Union address on 15th August 1971. President Nixon announced that the Americans would close the gold window. And what that meant was other countries could no longer convert dollar bills into gold bullion. This then takes us on to floating free currencies. The impact of that on the euro dollar market was that we switch very quickly. We still had fixed bonds, fixed interest rate bonds for longer durations, but we then also move into notes with note programs, which are floating rates. So what we're going to do is we're going to lend on a floating rate basis, so that the bank's profit is always fixed, but the interest that the borrower will repay over the term, which is the term of the advance, over the duration of the facility, that will vary depending upon how interest rates move. So we get this massive switch from the loan market onto the parallel bond market, but then into the note market, which is floating rate. What will then happen is we also have shorter duration instruments. So we're going to move down from long, let's say 20-year bonds, to short euro notes, maybe 2, 3, 4, 5-year euro notes. What then happened was the market went back up to medium term notes, 5, 10, 15-year notes, basically following the shape and pattern of the American domestic capital market. But now we have long bonds, fixed interest rates. We have notes with long notes, medium term notes, or short notes, short euro notes. And then if it's less than 1 year, we call it paper. So we can have paper for 6 months, 9 months, 11 months, anything up to 1 year, including down to 5 days, or even 2 or 3 days. If it's short, less than 1 year, it's paper. Otherwise, it's notes generally between 1 and 20 years, although technically and legally, if the interest rate is fixed, it's a bond, so you can have short bonds. If it's floating, it's a note. So we then get this trend, this develops in the market. So what happened was, and this is in the introductory paragraphs as well, there was a switch from the loan market into the bond market, and then specifically into the note market. But what also happened at the same time is we develop other types of facilities so that we can transfer loans. Loans technically were always difficult to transfer because this was impossible under common law originally, although we will then later develop types of assignment. Legal assignment and equitable assignment, and then also we can have novation, participation, other forms of transfer. But what also happened specifically was this. We're going to develop what we call transferable loan instruments or transferable loan certificates, which are TLIs or TLCs, as well as what we call transferable participation certificates, TPCs. So I've mentioned that in here as well. So what happens is, even though the loan market becomes a little less important relative to the bond and the note market, that recovers again because of the availability of the additional liquidity that these transfer instruments allow. Now, the basic distinction is this. A TLI, a transferable loan instrument, is an assignment. You assign. A TLC, transferable loan certificate, is a novation. The key difference is you can only assign benefits. You can't assign obligations. So if you want to transfer the obligations to pay or the obligations to lend, it has to be a novation. So usually we'll look at novations. You can only assign benefits, you can't assign obligations, so we have to consider novations as well. So what then happens is these become very important, which also allows the market to develop, because we then get these secondary instruments, we get a secondary market around the core primary loan market, which effectively makes the whole system look and operate parallel to the capital markets, because we're effectively selling loan participations on a secondary market in the same way as we could do with securities on the capital markets. One other important development is what we call the MOF, multi-option facility, or multi-option funding facility, which is in the sixth paragraph. This basically sets up a range of alternative facilities that the borrowers can rely on, which simply adds additional flexibility to their funding programs, which also then supports all of the different activities that they want to take forward. A typical MOF in practice will include what we call a short-term advance, which is a short-term loan. A swing line facility is very short-term, possibly 7 days, to allow you to borrow funds when you're switching between one facility and another. Commercial paper, or a euro commercial paper program, what we call bankers' acceptances. A lot of large companies still use bankers' bills of exchange. If you issue the bill of exchange, you can have a bank accept it, which stamps and signs, puts its credit onto it, which makes it as good as cash. So by issuing the bill of exchange, if it's accepted by one of the banks under a MOF, that means it's effectively as good as cash and can be transferred on, as well as what we call a medium-term note program. So the main thing about the MOF is that you will have both a short-term advance, which is a term facility, a loan facility, as well as a medium-term note facility, which allows you to issue notes into the market. The other key difference and key event that happened with the note program was that as the capital markets become shorter duration, as we get down from long 20-year bonds and then notes to much more shorter instruments, we call this disintermediation. Disintermediation refers to the fact that we're going to not need to bring the investment bank back in on every deal. We're going to set facilities up with programs or facilities which allow the companies themselves to sell the notes into the market. So instead of having one long 20-year bond or one long 20-year note, you could have four 5-year notes. Or you could have 10 2-year notes. And all that happens is after 2 years, the company repays the notes and then reissues them. Repays, reissues. Those can then either be committed or uncommitted, depending upon whether the bank that's involved has to purchase them or not purchase them if they can't be sold on into the market themselves. All of this creates maximum flexibility in terms of lending structures. The historical section simply outlines the background to all of this. We're looking at the origins of banking, going back initially to Italian banking. A lot of early practices came from the Italians following the city fair, the town fairs, and then the city fairs, and then the great fairs. The great fairs across Europe from the 1400s onwards, beginning in North Italy, then moving into other parts of Europe, Lyon, Bruges, Antwerp. These could last months, weeks or months. What would happen is all the merchants from all around Europe would come together and they would buy and sell their goods at these great fairs. The great fairs themselves would then develop their own legal systems, their own money in the form of the bill of exchange and the note, the promissory note. Specifically, what would happen is at the end of the fair, whether it's, let's say it was a 3-month fair, bill of exchange would circulate round and then at the end of the fair, it would be presented for settlement. So basically all the merchants could use this bill of exchange and just pass it on between each other, and then at the end they would settle. So you don't even need money, you certainly don't need specie, it could all be done through bills of exchange, even without the need for banknotes at that time. Banknotes themselves will not emerge until around the 1600s, 1650s. In the introductory paper, and in the separate historical chapters I've provided, I take this back even further. A lot of this goes way back to the House of Egebi in Egypt, or Babylon, 600 BC. So we had like 3, 4, 5 generations of bankers, 600 BC. We still have something like 1,500 tablets from that period, which were early forms of debt program, early forms of lending, early syndicated loans. We also have, for in terms of international banking, we have the Knights Templar, basically around the 1100s, Hugh de Payne. Basically, it was the Knights of Jerusalem who protected the lands to Jerusalem to allow people to go on pilgrimages. But what very quickly happened was the Knights developed their own cross-border finance system, banking system, so that you could deposit funds with them and then you would receive a note and then you could use that to cash in at any other preceptory anywhere around Europe. So we developed early forms of cross-border payment, early forms of deposit collection, account management. Very sophisticated forms of early banking were developed in the 1100s with the Knights Templar. They were effectively the first international bank. I also explained the later development of the Eurodollar system, the different types of facilities which are involved, different types of regulatory implications. What actually happened was after the Second World War, the dollar becomes the most important currency in the world under the Bretton Woods system, agreed at the Bretton Woods Conference in July 1944. The dollar replaces sterling specifically. However, the American authorities over-regulate the use of dollar in North America, which effectively doesn't drive, pushes and forces, but certainly encourages the banks to transfer all their dollar, excess dollar holdings to London. This is the origins of the euro dollar system. We had Regulation Q, we had Regulation D in the United States, which imposed interest rate ceilings and reserve requirements. This further encouraged the large American banks to move all their excess dollar holdings to London. So London emerges after the Second World War as the effectively an offshore financial center for dollar debt, but then also any other lending in any other currency in the world will come to London as well. At the same time as the international foreign exchange markets are principally based in London. This market is now currently worth around $6.2 trillion. It's expected to rise to $7.5 trillion a day 65% of that goes through London still. The rest of the euro-dollar market simply is lending in any currency outside the currency of issuance. So any lending in London other than sterling is euro-dollar. That's what we're talking about. The term euro-dollar is actually attributed to the first cable address for the first account that was opened for the Communist Party in China, the CCP, in 1949. We had the revolution in China in 1948. The Chinese had to move funds from New York to London. I think it was the Banque Commerciale pour l'Europe du Nord. Although it sounds French, I think it was actually a Russian bank. The cable address was Eurobank. So this is one of the first uses and origins of the euro dollar system. The reference was basically to the transfer of excess dollars from America to London and then the on-lending of that around the rest of the world. I explain also the origins of the bond market. The first bond deal was actually the S.G. Warburg deal in 1963 for $15 million. We're simply transferring debt from the loan market onto the bond market. We go from being private, personal, non-transferable to being fully transferable and negotiable. Negotiable means you acquire perfect title to something so long as you've no notification of a prior defect in title. It's the negotiability in this market specifically that adds much more liquidity, which means that you can borrow more at much finer rates in the euro-dollar markets. I also summarise the later development and emergence then of the note issuance facilities, the NIFs, which are these shorter rate programmes. We've both got the floating rates with the notes, as also the facilities as we get shorter duration instruments, and then later multi-option facilities as well. So I explained the background to all of that in the chapter. What we're also looking then is loan facilities. So what we need to understand is how we can use the basic simple term loan and a whole range of other types of relationships and arrangements all across the financial system and the economy. So these term loans form the basis for the euro loan market, the euro loan system. We can also use them for multi-purpose, multi-currency functions, multi-purpose uses. We specifically have dual currency loans, which allows the lenders to redenominate, while normally it's multi-currency, which means the borrowers can choose the currencies they want to draw down under. We can have term and revolving facilities, as we've already mentioned. Term is for a fixed duration. Revolving means you draw down and repay. If you repay a term facility, you cannot draw it down again. We'll then also get credit lines. Large companies don't have overdrafts. We call them credit lines. It's a facility that's made available so they can draw down funds either on a short or longer term basis. There's specific types of facilities you'll see there. We have multi-option facilities, MOFs, multi-option funding facilities we've mentioned before, but we can also have multi-currency revolving credit facilities, MRCFs. We can also have foreign exchange facilities, or foreign exchange credit lines, and other types of lines of credit. I mentioned all of that in the chapter. We've also got the use of these types of facilities for asset and property finance. Basically, we can use this specifically in the area of aircraft, shipping, lease financing, all of these types of sectors and sorts of arrangements. This can be very important indeed. In the area of aircraft, for example, what will happen is this. You'll have separate funding and finance contracts for the fuselage and then for each engine. So each engine and the fuselage have their own separate funding arrangements. So those will be tied to usually a term loan of some form, as well as a lease financing arrangement. So a lease company will actually buy the fuselage or the engines and then lease finance them back to the airlines. There's massive tax and other advantages which can arise with the use of these types of arrangements. And we can then use the same with shipping and shipping mortgages. We can also use this for project finance. Most commonly, technically, you could use capital market instruments in a large project finance deal. Most commonly, it will be a syndicated loan. So what will happen is you'll have a special purpose vehicle that's going to do something. It's going to construct an oil refinery, a plant of some form, a desalination system. It could be a hospital, it could be a hotel, it could be any type of facility that's going to generate an income. We call it non-recourse, because what's going to happen is we're going to build the plant, facility, arrangement. The income that's generated from that will repay all the costs of the construction, the lending, and the decommissioning. Very useful, very clever. Most of the major finance infrastructure projects in the world are based on project finance. The most common facility is a term loan in the middle of that. So we lend funds to the SPV to support its activities. It will also issue its own notes into the market, and we can use that to support the facility as well, although we also have term loans with this. This becomes even more important then in the structured finance area, whereby we use an SPV again, except this time the SPV is going to issue notes for it to purchase a pool of assets from a bank, an originating bank, which might be, for example, residential mortgages, corporate credit lines, or car loans, student loans, any other type of house financing arrangement. We can also use this for property finance purposes, commercial property, take out a term loan of some form. The advantage here is that we get rental flows as well as capital accretion and possibly other tax types of advantages we want to manage. We can also make this available in relation to acquisition finance, where we're using this in connection with the purchase of other companies. And then there's different structures we have here. We tend to talk about the use of different types of levels of debt. So we have mezzanine finance. We can have low risk and high risk instruments involved as well. There may be a term loan underneath this, although we can also combine this with the issue of new securities and also specifically new bonds. And then again, we can use this in subordinated loan structures, whereby we adjust the priority of the credit of the creditors to claim against the borrowers. So the borrowers will repay in a specific order as set out in terms of the subordinated debt structures established. The key sets of arrangements are then involved in the loan structures, and in particular in the financial terms and conditions that we're going to agree. And what we'll see is this. We're going to specify terms of availability in terms of the principal amount. The term is the duration. Interest, fixed or floating. We have drawdown and repayment, and then the other supporting obligations. So, principal, we need to agree the total amount that's made available. It could all be provided in one drawdown, and that's to do with making the funds available, although it's more likely it will be drawn down over a period in smaller amounts. But we need to agree the total principal amount that will be provided. This can be committed or uncommitted, which means the banks are under an obligation to lend as soon as the borrowers request it. If it's uncommitted, it means funds will be made available if they are separately available in the markets at an appropriate rate. The term is the duration. We can have maximum flexibility here. It could be very short, it could be very long. In practice, the euro loan market, we're looking 10, maybe 20 year loans. If you're borrowing that type of amount of money, 100 million, you want to have it available for an extended period. So 10, 20 years would be very typical. Interest, generally fixed or floating. We went from fixed in the bonds to floating for the note programs. We've already mentioned, in practice, we've shifted from what we called interbank offered rates, and in particular the London interbank offered rates. So we've gone from IBORs to risk-free assets, risk-free systems now. The most commonly used one in London is SONIA. We then have repayment. We can either repay on a single amount or we can amortize that. So for example, in the last 2 years of a 20-year facility, we may start repaying principal each month or every quarter in certain amounts towards the end. The borrowers may not want to be able to have to repay, come up with 100 million at the very end in a lump sum. So again, we can do this over stages, and we would call that amortization. The key point simply again is this: we have the core sets of financial provisions, we have the obligations which determine the rights and duties of the parties, and then we have the default clauses. So we'll see how all of this comes together, how all of this works in practice. But the financials that we've just looked at, they determine the basic structure of the arrangement and the relationship that we are establishing. In terms of core documentation, we need a mandate letter. The mandate letter is the letter of instruction that the arranging bank will receive, which gives it authority, legal and commercial, to set up the facility, to approach other banks and to begin to make all of the necessary arrangements to provide the lending. It's generally subject to contract. It's non-binding. It will be exclusive, and it's usually conditional on full credit assessment being conducted by the other parties and all of the necessary funds being made available. In terms of this idea of subject to contract, there is a presumption of legal intent. When you are dealing with another party, certainly in a commercial relationship, the assumption that's made by the courts is that you intend to give this legal effect. What we will do in practice in all of the negotiations and the legal documentation that we are looking at is that we will make this subject to contract. We express it to be subject to contract so that it doesn't come into effect and it doesn't give legal rights until we have concluded the final loan agreement and signed that. And you'll see in the footnotes in the chapter, subject to contract is used to reverse the presumption that commercial arrangements are intended to create legally enforceable relations. That's Edwards versus Skyway, 1964, 1 WLR 349. A contract can also be created even when all of the terms aren't agreed and documentation is still to be entered into. That was Branca versus Kubara, 1947, King's Bench, and the Anemone, 1987. This can also occur when non-essential provisions are left for future negotiation. Pagnam SPA versus Food Products. In all of these cases, we have to be very careful. We need to reverse this presumption of intent so that parties cannot attempt to enforce the contractual documentation, which is only draft, or the provisional clauses which are entered into. What we want to do is postpone legal effect only coming into effect once we've agreed the final terms of the loan agreement and signed and executed that to the agreement and intent of all of the parties concerned. We also then have the term sheet. The term sheet is going to summarise all of the key financials we've just mentioned. It now also adds all of the core legal provisions, and specifically the representations and warranties, the conditions precedent and the covenants, and then also the default clauses. It's virtually now like a summary loan agreement. It's essentially set up. It's like a schedule. It'll have columns. It basically operates the same as a full loan agreement in a summary form, because we need to understand all of that in advance, agree all of that, so that we can then move on, proceed to conclude the final loan agreement afterwards. We then have the information memorandum. The information memorandum is going to explain all the background information to the borrowing company and the borrower group. It will provide historical information as well as explain the nature of the borrower's business, the future prospects of the business, specifically what it intends to do with the funds that it's drawing down, and how it will repay those in practice in future. That's the main purpose of the information memorandum. Information memorandum effectively operates the same as a prospectus in a capital market arrangement. And if we're going to put this on a stock market exchange, the listing particulars. So the information memorandum, the prospectus and the listing particulars are effectively all the same thing, which we'll see whether we're looking at loan deals or we're looking at capital market deals. The information memorandum provides all the background information. It's probably the most difficult document to prepare simply because there will be an inherent inclination, need by the companies to overstate their position. They will always exaggerate. Your clients will always exaggerate. And that's where you create liability. That's where you can easily have misrepresentation, whether it's innocent, negligent, or fraudulent. You have to be very careful. And that's your responsibility. You need to look through this. You need to read through this. Anything that's not clear, any point of uncertainty, you refer back to the company and you have them confirm it either with their internal staff, their accountants, or their auditors. This is where the liability will arise. If something goes wrong and we have to set up some form of remedy and claim, including litigation, later it will be on the basis of this. You have to watch this. You have to be responsible for this. You have to be very careful. That's why this issue of liability is so important, and I will provide a separate draft chapter on liability. What we then do is we'll have the full loan agreement, and we'll come back and we'll look at that in further detail. The important point simply is this: these markets are so large, there is no agency, external entity of any form at the international or national level that could regulate, control these markets, simply because this is the largest companies in the world, and most of the governments in the world, this is where they borrow funds. You cannot regulate this on an official external basis. Therefore, we do on an internal self-regulatory model, basically using standard documentation. The trade associations in each market, which are basically the largest banks or investment firms, they come together, they set up a trade association. The trade association then instructs the largest law firms in the world, usually either in London or New York, mainly London, but for derivatives, it's also New York. What they then do is they prepare the standard documentation. So all of the rights and obligations and duties of all the parties in this market are set out in that documentation. We effectively create a surrogate, a proxy for official external regulation, so we need to look at these standard terms and conditions. The main trade association in the loan area is called the Loan Market Association. The LMA is based in London. We also have the International Capital Markets Association, the ICMA, for loans and bonds, bonds and notes. We also have the International Swaps and Derivatives Association, ISDA, for derivatives. And then there's a series of other trade associations as well, and I'll give you lists of these and I'll make that available on the system. The key point simply is this: we're going to use this standard documentation to establish an alternative form of control based on private law, private documentation, without the need for official external regulation. It's very clever, it's very efficient, it's very effective. It almost always works. We've also got this issue of fees. You'll have a separate fee letter, which will be explained usually with the mandate letter, so we can set out the different costs involved. The key point is this: there's three principal sets of fees which will apply with regard to the commitment fee, the management fee, and the agency fees. The commitment fee is the amount that the borrowers have to pay just for the facility being made available. It can be up to 0.7%. That seems actually quite high to me. The borrowers need to pay for the banks being available and ready to go into the markets and draw down. As we have explained separately, what actually happens is this: the banks do not have the funds available in their account to lend. They do not need that. In our example, $100 million has been drawn down by 10 companies, one parent and 9 subsidiaries, with 10 lending banks. The lending banks do not have to have $10 million each in their facility. All that will happen is that once the company begins to draw down, it sends what we call a utilization request to the agent bank. The agent bank then notifies each of the syndicate members the amount that's required. That's their share of the total amount. So let's say the parent company asks for $10 million on the first week, the beginning of the first week after the loan agreement's entered into. The agent bank will notify each bank, you are liable for $1 million each. Only then does that agent bank go into the interbank market, supporting the euro dollar markets, draw those funds down, and then make that available through the agent bank to the company. The banks do not need to have money in their accounts, because they don't. They will only draw down as they need it during the course of the facility. This is how this works. In terms of the actual procedure and the establishment of the deal, the transaction, how do we set everything up? I've summarized all that here. What normally happens is it's usually not the borrowers going to the arranging bank, the lead bank, asking for them to set the deal up. What will always happen is these large investment firms are always contacting the governments and the largest companies in the world, offering their facilities. Always, always, always. So basically, there's open offers available all the time. What will then happen, there's usually a competition between a couple of the arranging banks. So you may have to do some presentations or whatever. There'll be draft fees and quotes given as to how they're going to compete for the cost of setting this up. The company then decides which bank team it wants to use, and it will issue the mandate letter to them. So all I've done in this section here in the text is just explain how all of this works. So basically, the lead bank will normally have approached the borrower first. It will possibly, usually, certainly if it's a sovereign loan type situation, have to compete with others. If it's then awarded the contract in this particular case, it will begin work to collect the syndicate, form the group of banks which is going to provide the funding, and then start the legal documentation process. So we'll see. The borrower will award the lead bank or the arranging bank a formal mandate, and the lead bank will then instruct its solicitors to start to prepare all of the relevant documentation we need. The lead bank will have the draft term sheet available, and it will start to agree the terms, core provisions with the borrowers, the financial terms principally, and then take legal advice on any separate legal obligations, which are principally the obligations, the conditions precedent, the representations and warranties, and the covenants and the default clauses, which will all be in there. In practice, all of this is already preset out in the standard term sheets that the firms will use in practice. I'll show you some. I'll make one available to let you see what this looks like. We then draft the documentation. We're going to prepare the information memorandum, and we circulate the information memorandum around the syndicate members to allow the members to determine, do they want to participate and are they going to lend? Essentially, what's happening is they're undertaking their own credit assessment. They form their own opinion as to the credit worthiness of the borrower and decide, will we lend, how much will we lend, and at what cost. And what will actually happen is, in the loan document itself, all of this will be confirmed. Each of the participating banks will be required to confirm, to state that it undertook its own individual credit assessment. Why? Because the lead bank doesn't want any of them suing it if anything goes wrong. And this is one of the protections that the lead bank will insist on, and that as lawyers we will build into the documentation to ensure that we protect our clients' interests. We will prepare the other documentation and we'll circulate it, we'll take comment, and we'll prepare the final documentation. There will then be a closing when everything is signed. In practice, it may have been assumed that the funds will be made available immediately at that time. They will not be provided as such. It's not like a cheque is handed over. That's not how these systems work. What will happen is, on the signing, that will commence the commitment period, so that the borrowers will then be able to draw down under the facility. What they will then have to do, it's not like just handing a cheque over. What will happen is that the borrowers will have to draw down, usually in one of the schedules, I think it's Schedule 2, to the LMA standard multi-currency document that we will look at. You will draw down by serving a utilization request on the agent bank. The agent bank then notifies each of the syndicate members their share of this amount. So those banks then go into the market, draw down, and make that available to the agent bank, which passes it on to the borrower. What we'll also see in practice is this. The arranging bank very often is only looking to receive the agency fee. So we mentioned the commitment fee. So what will happen is that a commitment fee is paid by the borrower to the banks to make available the funds under the facility. even if the borrower doesn't draw down, it may still have to pay a fee on the undrawn amounts, just because the banks have undertaken to make that available if it's requested. What will also happen is the agent bank gets its fee, but it's going to be very small, very low, because it's only, and usually only on a sort of like hours or like in a day committed basis, as it's required to carry on different functions. Most of these are more of an administrative nature, so therefore it's a much lower fee. What also happens is that we have to agree the arranging bank's fee. The arranging bank's fee typically could be 0.5%, possibly a little more if it's suitable in the particular case and the agent bank is of appropriate standing. Although in practice what will have happened is other banks will have competed to be awarded the contract, so it will force this amount down. So it may have started at 100%, 100 basis points, but then be pushed down to maybe 0.5. 0.5 is very common. So the arranging bank's going to get 0.5 of 100 million as a fee for setting this up. And all of this can maybe be done in a 4-week period, very simply. But what will happen is this: the arranging bank won't actually want to lend. It will say it's going to lend to bring in the other syndicate members, because it looks like it's then participating with the others on an equal basis. So that encourages the others to become involved. In practice, what will very often happen is this: the arranging bank sells on its commitment to lend even before the closing. So it will enter into a separate participation or transfer arrangement whereby it's going to bring another bank in to make available its, in our example, 10 million available. If we have a sub-participation, a participation, or a blind participation, what will happen is this: the borrower doesn't even know. Even at the closing, when everyone's signing with the arranging bank, the arranging bank has already, the day before, entered into a separate sub-participation arrangement whereby another bank's going to come in, another smaller commercial bank, and make available that 100 million. That's a blind participation, sub-participation, the borrower does not even know. All of this then is entered into, all of this is given effect to, and that's the basic procedure to see how all of this can be set up and come into effect in practice. What we then need to do is we need to look at the nature of the syndication itself. What we're going to do is understand the nature of the relationship between all of the banks involved. We can summarise this in terms of a series of key ideas: severality, proportionality, equality, democracy, and limited agency function. The limited agency function then corresponds in practice by complete coincidence almost identically with the scope of function of the agent bank. And we can summarise that in terms of receipt duties, payment duties, banking duties, notification duties and default duties. And all I've done in the chapter is explain how each of these operates, the basic principles behind them, and then refer to the specific clauses in the standard documentation that we're going on to look at. What we need to understand is this: we're dealing with a group of highly professional banks dealing with each other as principals in a market that they are very experienced in and very professional with regards to, and have very substantial amounts of knowledge in relation to. It's not like this is a brokerage relationship. It's not like there's any advice involved or any advantage of any form. The banks know what they're doing. They're dealing as principal. They're coming in as principal. They're going to be lending as principal. So it's all based on equality. It's all based on severality. It's all based on proportionality. But the banks are able and ready and will want to protect their own interests. There may be some limited issues assigned for majority voting. If there is majority voting, it will be qualified majority, 66 3/4 rather than 50%. But in all more important key issues, there won't be any delegation of authority. There won't be any surrender of authority to majority voting. The banks will want full consensus, full 100%, and will want to be able to protect their own interests. There are some interesting points that arise, and we'll see that from a legal perspective. Each of the banks is several. It's coming into this severally. It's not joint and severally liable for any other bank. So if one bank steps down, the other banks don't have to make up the difference. What will happen is the lead bank will bring in another bank, a substitute bank, before closing, or the agent bank will find another bank after closing. But we'll then see strict rules about exiting of institutions. You cannot exit until someone else has come in to replace you. And the same applies with regards to the agent bank. There is provision for the agent bank to stand down, but only once another appointed bank is brought in to carry out all of its functions. Also, what we're going to see is this. The relationship between the syndicate and the borrowers will be expressly stated to be separate and several, or separate and independent. Now, why do we state that? It's so that we create a separate relationship and direct relationship between each of the lending banks and the borrowers, so that the lending banks protect their own rights against the borrower. For example, set off. Other rights it may have, you need to protect those, and it can enforce those independently without having to go to the other bank. So the rights and remedies are several as well as they're separate, which means each of the banks can separately enforce without having what we need for joinder. We don't have to join or co-join other banks by bringing them into an action before we can sue the borrower. So all of this is set out in specific terms and specific words to make all of this clear in practice. That each of the banks has a direct, immediate, completely separate, independent relationship with the borrower. And again, that all of the separate loans are completely distinct, even though all of this is governed by one single, very well drafted loan documentation. Now, what we will see, there are some qualifications to that in the fact that we will have equality clauses and sharing clauses so that no one bank can get an advantage over another bank. And that includes sharing. So specifically, if one bank receives a payment that it's not shared with the other banks and other banks did not receive an equivalent amount of, that has to be paid back to the agent bank. The agent bank then divides that up and shares it around the other banks. So we have these other sharing clauses to ensure that everybody benefits equally. There are some exceptions to that, so that if one bank notifies all the other banks through the agent bank, I'm going to take action and you're invited to join or come in, but you don't do so, if the bank receives something in that case, then it can probably keep it. But we have to look at the specific drafting and the particular terms of the documentation in each case to determine that. I have summarised in the paper basic provisions and the importance of this idea of agent bank and lead bank liability. I've then dealt with that separately in a longer, independent, separate paper. The point simply is this. If anything goes wrong, if the borrower and the borrower's group cannot repay, who's going to pay? The banks that have lent the funds, who can they go against? Who can they recover from? They could try suing each other, but none of the other banks have done anything, and they've all acted independently and severally, so they can't sue anybody else. So who else is available? You've only got the arranging bank and the lead bank. In practice, what we're going to do is we're going to very carefully draft this documentation in such a way that only if either the lead bank or the agent bank has acted negligently or with gross disregard to other parties' interests or in a completely incompetent manner, could there be any recovery. But what we want to ensure, and we'll see this in the documentation, there's a whole series of protection and exclusion clauses which mean that the banks, the syndicate, cannot sue the arranging bank, nor can they sue the agent bank. And we'll see how all of this works in practice. As a lawyer, it is our duty to ensure that our clients' interests are protected and that they have no liability under any circumstances, and certainly any circumstances that have not been anticipated and explained and advised to the client in advance. We can deal with all of that through well-drafted documentation, so we just need to understand how all of this operates and applies in practice. We then have the loan conditions and obligations. I've explained that the three core sets of provisions are the financials, the obligations, and the defaults. In terms of the obligations, what we have is the conditions precedent. We have the representations and warranties, and then we have the covenants which apply on a continuing basis. it is generally assumed that the CPs are pre-agreement, the reps and W's pre-drawdown, and the covenants post-drawdown. If we actually go through the clauses and spend time on these, looking at them in further detail, what tends to happen is the CPs are effectively repeated on each drawdown, so they're effectively pre-advance. The representations and warranties move forward in their pre-loan agreement, and then the covs are post-drawdown or post-agreement. That tends to be legally the way it operates. It's not quite what we expected, superficially, prima facie, but in practice that's how it operates. Now, I've explained the different types of clauses that we can have in these agreements and the different types of status that the law will attach to different types of contractual provision. And this is very important, because what we're effectively doing is this: we'll have a whole series of statements, rights, representations made, and all of these kind of different legal effects. What we're essentially going to do is this: what the banks ultimately want is they want the ultimate remedy, which is rescission. They want to be able to rescind the document. In practice, they're not going to rescind, because rescind will then mean default. And specifically, it will trigger a cross default and all the other facilities outstanding that the borrower has in place. It's not that it's going to want to enforce, it's that by having the ability to enforce, it puts the bank in a very strong negotiating position. In practice, we're generally going to reschedule, renegotiate, come up with some alternative repayment terms. That's what everybody generally wants. But we need the threat of closure, cancellation, full remedy to put the banks in a strong position. For that reason, we want rescission. The problem is this: breach of different types of contractual provisions of itself does not create or give right to rescission. So what we're going to do is this: we're going to elevate certain provisions by treating them like other provisions, and then we're going to further secure our protection by tying those in to the default clauses, by making them express events of default. Now, we'll see that in the text here. So what we've got is this. I'm looking at, this is the loan conditions and obligations. And in the footnotes down here, we've got various different sets of provisions. So we've got the conditions precedent, we've got the representations and warranties, and we've got the covenants. The legal effect of the conditions precedent, this is in footnote 174, is that if it's not satisfied, there is no obligation to lend. The bank can also withdraw from the agreement at any time before the conditions have been satisfied. That's Pym versus Campbell. There's then a number of other provisions which apply with regards to this, and the rights that we have for breach of the conditions precedent, we need to consider how this applies in practice. We can look at this in very simple terms, but also it becomes quite complex depending upon the specific issues that apply in any particular case, and I've expanded all of that in the text. We also need to consider the reps and W's. A representation, this is footnote 175, consists of a statement of fact rather than law. So a representation is a statement of fact, not a statement of law. That's Leaf International Galleries. A warranty is an undertaking or promise to act. A warranty is an undertaking or promise to act. In practice, most representations and warranties are only representations. They're not warranties at all. But what we're going to want to do is this: we're trying to elevate representations up to warranties. So the drafting will say something like, the borrowers warrant and represent, or represent and warrant. You see, we're trying to elevate them so we create equal status. Again, however, breach of those does not create rescission. We only get damages. Damages sound effective, sound useful, but that's not actually the remedy that we want. And again, I expand on all of this in further detail in the chapter and in the footnotes. So again, we're going to want to elevate. So what we'll see is this: representations are not, however, incorporated as terms of the contract directly under English contract law. That's Oscar Chess versus Williams and Dick Bentley production. Even if a term is incorporated as a warranty, breach only gives us damages. It doesn't give us rescission. What we need to do is to elevate the representations to warranties, and then the representations and warranties, we need to elevate those up to conditions, because then we get the rescission we're looking for. In practice, what we're trying to do is turn all of these into conditions, and then we're going to support that, and I explain this in the text and in the footnotes, by tying it in directly to the events of default. So a breach of any of these will constitute full default. But this is what we're trying to do, because each of these different terms has different status with a different remedy under law, specifically under contract law. So we need to consider this. And again, there's some famous case law here. Bunge Corporation versus Tridex, Tridex and Wallace versus Pratt. In conclusion, we're going to elevate each of these together, and then we're going to tie them into an express event of default, so that this default, we have full rescission, and then we can control and command direct the renegotiation process, which will hopefully, I was going to say inevitably, but hopefully arise. There's some quite interesting, subtle points of law here, which I would encourage you to consider. In terms of the actual content of these obligations, what have we got? The conditions precedent are essentially to do with the constitutional legal status and position of the borrower and the borrower's group. So everything applies to the borrower and each of the companies in the borrower's group. So what we'll need is this. We need constitutional documents. We need any separate sovereign confirmations, declarations or authorizations. We need all the security to be confirmed. In practice, a standard euro-dollar deal is unsecured. But for specific types of deal, there may be security, so we need to confirm the validity, relevance, application, content, quality of the security. We'll always take legal opinions. We need a legal opinion on the enforceability of all of this in each jurisdiction which is relevant to protect the interests of the banks. So if all the borrowers are in 9 different countries and the parent bank, the parent borrower is in a separate country, we'll need 10 legal opinions. If the security is then in another country, we'll need another legal opinion on that, as well as any other jurisdictions which may be relevant. So we'll instruct lawyers in these overseas jurisdictions to prepare an appropriate legal opinion. This is something that you will become an expert on drafting. Legal opinions is a very interesting, important area of law. The legal opinions, again, are actually all drafted in fairly standard terms, the standard templates that we use. The first 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 pages usually state what the legal opinion will not cover. It's a whole series of protections so that the bank which is giving the legal opinion cannot be held liable if anything goes wrong. Well, a whole series of exclusions and protections, and then we will confirm the various points which are covered by the legal opinion, which are usually tied back to the conditions precedent and the representations and warranties, on which the local legal agent feels it can legally give advice and confirm. That's how this actually operates in practice. These can be quite long, typically 12, 14, 16 pages, possibly longer. But as I've said, half of it very often is excluding, is they're protecting themselves and excluding what they're not going to cover. But very important area of practice. What we also have then is any other confirmations and other supporting evidence, as well as what we call conditions subsequent. So these are the conditions precedent, but we can also impose conditions subsequent. In practice, as I've already explained, what will effectively happen is that the borrower will only be able to draw down by serving a utilization request, and an express condition will be that all of the conditions precedent have been satisfied. Now, what does that mean? That effectively repeats each CP every time there's a drawdown. Now, we can also have express what we call evergreen clauses, and evergreen means it applies at all times. So we'll expressly provide that certain clauses are evergreen, so they have to be complied with on a continuing basis. And then we will have repeaters. Repeaters mean this is automatically or expressly has to be restated, reconfirmed each time something happens, usually on a drawdown. Then we have the representations and warranties. As we have already explained, a representation is a statement of fact, not a statement of law, as the presumption is that everyone is assumed to know the law. A warranty is an undertaking to act. So two different things. It's a statement of fact and it's an undertaking to act. We will have two sets of reps and W's. We have the legal warranties and we have the financial or commercial warranties. And again, we'll begin to see where we now have overlap. We've got possibly accounts and other documents being provided. We'll have information set out in the legal and then in the financial warranties and representations. And then we're going to support these with the continuing financial covenants as well afterwards. We're going to have corporate covenants, and we're going to have legal covenants, and we're going to have commercial covenants, financial covenants. So a lot of this actually begins to overlap in practice. What we're trying to do is just reinforce the operation of all of this to make sure it applies equally and properly and secures and protects the interests of the banks as the lenders in all cases. The legal warranties, again, will confirm the status. So they go back to the status, it's already been partly confirmed in the CPs. There'll be other references to binding obligations are stated to be legal, valid, binding and enforceable. Other provisions will apply with regards to no conflicts, necessary power and authority, authorization, governing law and enforcement, possibly no immunity clause, no withholding tax, and no other litigation actual contemplated or threatened. So we make these statements to confirm that the borrower is in a position to enter into these arrangements and that the lending structure that we are going to give effect to is fully enforceable and that the bank's interests are properly protected. We will then have the separate financial representations and warranties confirming the financial condition, financial position of the borrower and the borrower's group is this at this time, and that the borrower is in a position to be able to deliver and discharge all of its obligations under the documentation which we're going to enter into. What I was saying was this then overlaps with the CoVs, so we're going to confirm, evidence, state, determine, basically promise to be valid the financial condition pre-loan, pre-drawdown, but then we're going to support that with the other financial ongoing covenants which we apply subsequently. So we then have the CoVs. The covenants apply on a continuing basis after loan agreement and after drawdown. We again divide these into two lots, or actually four lots. We've got the corporate covenants. The corporate covenants principally consist of what we call the negative pledge clause. Other key provision is called the pari passu, and then the disposals. Then we have the separate financial covenants. We'll also have some information provision covenants, and then any other separate general undertakings or general covenants. This is very important because effectively what we're doing is this. The banks want to protect their interests by preserving the assets and the business condition and profitability of the company without becoming involved in the day-to-day business and administration of the company. They don't want to become shadow directors, because if they're held to be shadow directors, they can be held liable for decisions the company's taken or actions the company has or has not done. So we have things like environmental liability, we have legal liability, all sorts of areas, all sorts of ranges the banks could be held responsible for. The banks do not want to become shadow directors. They don't want to become intimately involved in the day-to-day business, but they need to preserve their interests in terms of being able to recover against the company and the company's assets. So that's what these covenants are for. It's to give the banks as much protection as we legally can without them actually taking over the business of the firms, which they don't have the experience or interest to actually run or manage, but we need to be able to protect the bank's interests. So what do we have? Key provision is the negative pledge. What we're trying to do is prevent the borrowers from creating any other security which could undermine the recovery of the banks in this particular case. This is generally an unsecured loan if it's a traditional standard euro loan deal, but what we don't want is any other adverse negative pledge interest coming in. But this actually becomes quite complicated in practice. A number of quite subtle issues actually arise. What we have to do is this. We have to draft the negative pledge as absolutely wide as possible to include as many security interests as possible so that it applies in almost any situation that could be relevant. But at the same time, we then need to apply an appropriate set of exclusions and concessions so that it's not triggered too easily in practice. So we'll see how that works in terms of the actual documentation. And I've set all of this out in the paper. So what we're trying to do is this. We're going to cover effectively all types of security interest. So this will apply with regards to charges. A charge is a security interest just created by direction. This was Section 395 of the Companies Act 1985. It's now Section 859A 2 of the Companies Act 2006, section 859A, 2 in brackets. What used to happen was we had a 395, and every young lawyer would spend a very large part of their career filing 395s. You had to file the 395 within 30 days every time a company created a charge or a security. And if you didn't do it, it was of no legal effect. So what would happen in very large complex deals, and I've seen this so many times, everybody forgets about the 395s. So you've all this massively complex security, hundreds of millions, billions of dollars worth of funds involved at risk, and then people forget to file the 395s. It's a very important thing. It will happen to you. It's something you'll be required to do. It's something you have to treat very, very seriously. Simply because if you don't file them, they're unenforceable, which could destroy the whole economic and legal effectiveness of the rest of a $100 million dollar transaction. It used to be called a 395. It's now called, the registered charge form is now an MRO1. An MRO1, which you have to file with Companies House. But security will always still be extended to include a pledge. A pledge is a security created by possession. You deliver possession, that's a pledge. But you also get a lien. A lien arises whenever you've got control over an asset. So garages have liens, hotels have lien over customers' luggage. So we have to think about this in terms of covering charges, pledges, liens, as well as mortgages, debentures, every other possible type of security we'll want to include, so that we make this apply as widely as possible. And again, as in all of this, it will apply both with regards to the company and all of the borrowers and all of the other companies concerned. However, having said all of that, we don't want to trigger this in every situation on everything the company does on a day-to-day basis. So there'll be a whole series of assets that we'll need to exclude. So, for example, netting, set-off, general liens. For example, the photocopy machine will have a lien over that. And even the paper, the boxes of photocopy paper that delivered, they'll have retention of title clauses so that the company that's provided the paper retains title till the bill's been paid. And they will have a security interest over that, which will effectively involve them having legal title, so it's still theirs until you've paid the bill for what's concerned. There's all sorts of other sort of daily operations which will apply. This will apply with regards to the photocopy machine, the fax machines, the telecommunications machines, the coffee machines. It's a whole series of things, including all of the furniture very often. What you're trying to do is exclude all of this so that on a daily basis, the company can continue in operation at the same time as we're trying to be as comprehensive as we can to protect the bank's interest so that it's the assets of the company are not undermined in any way that would be adverse to the bank's ability to recover. We also then have a pari passu clause. Pari passu means that this lending situation is kept on an equal, unsubordinated, unsecured basis on the same terms as every other creditor in that class. Pari passu. We then have disposals. This supports the negative pledge clause. And if you're discussing negative pledge, tie it in with the disposal clause. What we're trying to do is preserve assets. We don't want the companies making any disposal of large material assets, which could again undermine the bank's ability to recover. That of itself will constitute an event of default. And again, depending on how you define this could be a subsidiary. It might be a material part of the bank's business, of the borrower's business. It could be very significant intellectual property rights. It could be data rights, or it could be a subsidiary. There's all sorts of things that we could consider within this. We need to look at this. And in practice, you'll have to be able to advise your clients on this, whether you're acting for the bank or for the borrower. Again, however, we'll need certain reasonable exceptions. The most common clause provision will be a de minimis. A de minimis is below a certain value. So we're lending 100 million. We're not concerned with security interest under the negative pledge or disposal clauses when something's worth $10,000 or $5,000. So there'll be a de minimis figure in virtually all of these agreements and in many of these clauses. Below this figure, we're just not interested because it's not material to the bank's ability to collect payment of interest and repayment on default. We then have the financial covenants. The financial covenants are very important. because this gives the banks a very substantial degree of control over the activities of the borrower. This will be supported by the other information covenants, but the financials are the most important. What have I done in this chapter is I've identified a number of them. Minimum net worth, earnings to interest, that's called the EBITDA, debt to earnings, dividend limits, liquidity and leverage. There's at least 25, if not more. And in my full project finance chapter, I go through this in a lot more detail because it becomes a lot more relevant in these larger complex finance project finance deals. For our purposes, in a standard euro loan deal, these are the key ones we're looking at. Minimum net worth and EBITDA. EBITDA is earnings before interest, taxation, depreciation, and amortization. It essentially does the borrower have enough money to pay the bank interest on a monthly basis? It's an earnings ratio, it's an earnings figure. We need the EBITDA to stay above a certain figure. If it goes below it, that raises major red flags with the banks. Major point of concern. If that happens, the company will have to report that to the bank, and then that very often will trigger full default. There's also debt to earnings, dividend limits, so that we don't pay dividends unless there's enough sufficient earnings to cover that. Other controls on liquidity, other controls on leverage of the company's ability to borrow. And with those very small, it seems like a narrow range of protections, that gives us a very substantial degree of control. And without becoming shadow directors, the banks can exercise a very significant degree of oversight and management of the activities of the borrower without actually becoming shadow directors in practice. So we need to watch these. As lawyers, we're not actually concerned with the mathematics, but we need to understand how they work because we'll be drafting this. This will be in our documentation and we are responsible for that. And if we can understand it, it actually it's very interesting in the negotiations. You'll certainly want to insist that these are provided. You will be shown other alternative clauses. You need to understand this more than you need to have enough ability to be able to discuss and exchange ideas and decide on the final drafting of these provisions. A lot of it might be done by the accountants or the auditors in practice. The accountants are the financial advisors inside the firm. The auditors are the external accountants who come and confirm the validity of the final accounts, annual accounts for each year. They will prepare a lot of this, but we need to understand it so that we can advise and be involved with this. As I've said already, you've also got information covenants which support all these other covenants, in particular with regards to instances which might threaten the stability of the group, so the banks need to have that advised in advance or as soon as possible after something occurs. There will be other supporting provisions, specific events which have to be notified to the banks so they can understand what's happening. And then there may be a series of other general undertakings imposed as well. Essentially, what we have with all of this is a very substantial amount of ability to understand what the borrowers are doing, to indirectly control their activities, to keep them within safe, relevant economic limits, and to protect the interests of the banks. What we're then going to do is we're going to reinforce all of this by tying it into the default provisions. So we have loan default. There's going to be a series of standard default clauses that we need to work through. In every case, you will check each of these because they're of absolutely essential importance to the banks. The borrowers will try to dilute them. Their lawyers will negotiate as many of these down as they can. The banks will want to strengthen these to the extent that they can. Key default clauses then apply with regards to breach of the financial provisions, the financial covenants, obviously. Breach of other non-financial covenants. Non-payments first, clearly. Breach of the covenants, breach of the non-financial covenants. Misrepresentation, as we said before. You need to watch this. It's very easy to misrepresent something in practice. You need to be very careful. You need to develop a feel for this so that in all cases, if there's anything that's uncertain, you have to have it confirmed. Because otherwise, it's going to create liability. Now, it might not be rescission, but it could be damages, either for your client or for somebody else. So misrepresentation, then cross-default. The two most difficult clauses to negotiate and to apply in practice are the cross-default, and the last one is called the material adverse change, the MAC clause, so the CD and the MAC. The CD is important because what's going to happen is this. If you trigger default, you're automatically going to trigger default in every other outstanding agreement, which will include loans and capital market facilities. So the question is this. You want to be quick, but not too quick. But if you're not quick enough, you could lose financial benefit, financial advantage. It's a difficult clause to advise. It's one of the clauses that clients need will need support on. They will call you up and ask for advice on this because they don't know what to do in a particular case. Should we trigger default? Should we not trigger default? A lot of it's going to be automatic because of the more important defaults above it, but for other more discretionary instances, areas of default, should we trigger a default? The point simply is, once you trigger default, you've effectively, automatically created default in every other outstanding facility, which that, in practice, means liquidation. So instead of collecting 100 cents in the dollar, you might be collecting 65, 35, 25, 10. If the borrower and the borrower's group go into full liquidation and you're an unsecured creditor, you have possibly very limited rights of recovery. We then have other express forms of insolvency, other creditor process, other loss of control, other illegality, any separate repudiation, which kind of corresponds with non-payment, and then we're into the MAC clause. The MAC, again, what we're trying to do is this. We want this to be as wide as possible so that we have as maximum control and protection as possible. But again, we can't have it too generous and too easy to trigger. Because if it's too easy to trigger, you then get an automatically default on this agreement and then other agreements, which then starts the cross-default process elsewhere. We have to be careful with this. So you're trying to draft it as generally as wide as possible so that it gives you as much control, but not so irresponsibly that it's too easy to breach and then trigger all sorts of other difficulties for the company and then for yourselves. You also have to consider, does the material adverse change, is it a change in the market conditions or is it a change in the conditions of the borrower? So there's different issues, there's different ways of looking at this. There's also sort of separate, we can have material adverse changes, we can have material adverse effects, there's other types of language which is also used. I've provided some additional guidance on parts of this, elements of this on the system. This is one of the very difficult clauses to negotiate. The borrower is going to want this to be safe and stable, exclusionary as possible. The banks are going to want it to be as inclusive as possible. The problem is, even if you're a bank and you win, if it's too easy to trigger, it's going to cross across default, and then it's basically cancellation suspension. Just on the default remedies, there's some other interesting case law on how you actually proceed with this. In practice, you'll generally want to make a demand, but once you make a demand, that actually starts the recovery. The point here simply is this. It's then strict enforcement. So the borrower may have very little time to actually pay or provide the funds. So once you've made demand, you have to make demand, but once you make demand, and there's case law on this as well. Once you make demand, the borrower may have days, hours to try and find the funds. And if it can't find the funds, that's full non-payment. So therefore, it's full default. So you started the full closure procedure. The breach could be almost of anything, and there will be strict application of these rules in practice. You have to be very careful if you're acting for the borrower and advising them with regards to their rights and interests which apply in any particular case. There is some interesting supporting case law which develops this. The rest of the chapter then considers loan transfers and then loan rescheduling. The point is that it was impossible under the common law to transfer a personal debt obligation. It's why we used to have debtors' prisons. If you couldn't pay, you went to jail because there was no other remedy. Now we can transfer through assignment, legal or equitable. Legal assignment is now effected under the Law of Property Act 1925, section 136. There's generally three conditions. It has to be for an unconditional amount, and this causes problems in practice because very often amounts are conditional, not unconditional. So we have to be careful about that. Also, it has to be in writing, which is easy, but you have to give notice to the debtor for full legal assignment. So under Law of Property Act 1925, Section 136, you have to give notice. In practice, the banks don't want to tell the borrowers they're transferring their interest to somebody else, even if it's their own, for example, special purpose vehicle in an offshore financial centre. They just don't want to tell them. In closed types of deals and transactions, this is not a problem, but in other situations, it could be difficult, simply because if you've only got an equitable assignment, if the someone else who receives the asset and gives notice to the borrower before you, they get full legal protection and you get nothing. That's the problem that can arise. So we have legal assignment and equitable assignments. In practice, if it's a closed type of deal situation, for example, with securitizations, project finance, we're not that concerned because there's not any other outside parties and we're controlling everything anyway. We've got a lot of ability to exercise and direct what's happening. So legal assignment and equitable assignment, the distinction is not that important, and very often you'll just rely on an equitable assignment. The problem, however, is this. You can only assign benefits. If you need to transfer obligations, if one of the banks wants to step down, such as the arranging bank, you can't assign an obligation. Therefore, you have to use full novation. Novation is substitution. That means you're bringing in another party to legally assume all of your obligations and rights and benefits. So we go for novation. We then have participation, sub-participation, risk participation. Participation and sub-participation is essentially when you bring in another party behind you. So that's what the lead bank will do. It will bring in another smaller commercial bank to actually make available the 10 million. That's a participation. We could call it a sub-participation if it's blind. It's blind, it means that the borrower doesn't know. The funds aren't coming from the lead bank, they're coming from another bank. The last deal I did, I think it was UBS was the arranging bank. Moscow Narodny, a Russian bank, was the sub-participant. It was coming in and providing the funds that were going to be made available by the lead bank. All it wanted was a large arranging fee to leave, move on and start the next deal. We've also got other types of transfers. A risk participation is where there's some contingent element. It's not an absolute liquid amount at this stage. It might be, for example, under a letter of credit or a guarantee. Anything that's more contingent, you'd have a risk participation. So somebody else would come in to cover that in case there was non-payment. You can also, we have references in some of the books to trusts, securitization, agency relationships. You can effectively create the same effect by transferring the economic interests without legally transferring the asset. So I'm not sure they're legal assignment, they're not they're legal transfers, but they can create an economically equivalent condition and situation. Trusts, securitization, and even agency relationships, brokerage relationships. And then we have rescheduling. And all we're looking at the end is restructuring and rescheduling. The point simply is this. The banks are going to be very reluctant to cancel the deal. The five remedies they will have on default are suspension of further advance, cancellation of further advance, acceleration, that's when you make demand, I want repayment, so acceleration is repayment. You then have rescission, and then you have separate litigation. You sue for recovery afterwards. In practice, the banks will hardly ever want to rescind, because rescind is terminal. What they'll want to do is renegotiate from a position of strength. That's what they're trying to do. The general rules simply are this. You will try to extend the duration, lower the interest, but protect the principal. That's what you're trying to do. If it's a sovereign loan, if a country's involved, we have what we call the London Club and the Paris Club. The Paris Club applies to loans between governments, so it's sovereign to sovereign. The London Club is sovereign to bank, banks lending to sovereigns. London is for where the banks are involved, Paris Club is where it's only governments involved. The Paris Club, slightly more formal, usually in Paris, a member of the Ministry of Finance in Paris will usually chair the meetings. London Club's a bit more flexible, not always held in London. Might be London, might be New York, might be Shanghai. Difference is, sovereign to sovereign is Paris Club, sovereign to bank is London Club. You also may have what we call heavily indebted companies, heavily indebted poorer countries, so therefore you can trigger this, the HIPC rules under the International Monetary Fund or the World Bank. So there's other rescheduling renegotiation provisions which apply as well. The general rule is this. Governments and international financial institutions will protect their principal. They won't want that reduced. You can get haircuts and write-offs on the private debt. And we saw this, for example, with Greece after the global financial crisis in 2012. I think the private debt was written down about 35%. But the International Monetary Fund, the European Commission, and the other international financial institutions, they wanted payment. They wanted full recovery. So they weren't going to write down principal. They would extend maturity, lower the interest rate, but they weren't going to write off the debt as such. With private debt, you can write it off. The other key rule is simply this. For governments, principally, but also companies, you always service your capital market debt. You pay your bonds and your notes because you always want to be able to get into the market later. So what you'll do is you'll renegotiate your bank credit, your outstanding loans, credit facilities, you pay, you service your capital debt, and then renegotiate your bank debt. That's the way it generally works. There are exceptions. Recently, I think Argentina did the opposite, which could cause major problems because when Argentina then goes back into the market, tries to borrow down on the bond market or the note market, its credit assessment, its credit rating is going to be materially damaged. If you want to borrow the most at the finest rates, you want to keep your credit standing on the markets with the big credit reference agencies, Standards, Moody's and Poor, and Fitch are the three main ones in America. What you're trying to do is keep your credit standing as high as possible. But the American Treasury bill, the American debt's already been written down, as have another of other sovereign countries. What does that mean? It means you have to pay a higher interest. You can borrow less, but usually at higher interest, possibly borrow the same, but then you pay even more. So we have rescheduling. In practice, we don't want to call default, because if we call default, it's insolvency. So therefore, instead of collecting 100 cents on the dollar, we're going to be collecting 65, 35, 10. So always negotiate where you can, and these general provisions and rules which apply with regards to that. All of this then is dealt with in the chapter. All of this is covered in detail. And I'll also add appropriate cross-references to other supporting materials, other relevant references that you may require.